previously broadcast program.
The FM band is from 88 megahertz up to 108.
You've got this frequency. We're going to call you CKUP. You've got this frequency, 98.3. That frequency is what you're picking up when you tune that radio.
Very impressive.
You can sit on the moon and it looks like they pick up CKUP, clear as a bell.
Fascinating. Your analysis seems logical.
CKUP is on the air.
Welcome to Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal's only queer culture show that bridges any divide between queer sex and radical queer politics. Due to the fabulous nature of queer experience, tonight's program may contain sexually explicit or coarse language. You've been advised.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
From the Advocate magazine, in partnership with GLAAD, this is LGBTQ&A. I'm Jeffrey Masters, and on the podcast recently, we've been talking a lot about HIV with people like Peter Staley, Sarah Schulman, Anne Northrup. And today, I wanted to continue and expand on those conversations by bringing you an episode of Making Gay History featuring Larry Kramer. Making Gay History, if you don't know, is an incredible podcast hosted by someone who's become a dear friend, that is Eric Marcus. Eric got to interview Larry Kramer back in January of 1989. This interview really shows his softer side in a way that I find extremely compelling. He ends the interview by saying that he loves being gay. Even with everything going on with HIV, even with the suicidal ideation you'll hear him talk about, heads up there, even with all of that, he still calls being gay a wonderful, wonderful thing. So if you enjoy our podcast, I think you will also enjoy Making Gay History. And without further ado, let's hear it.
I'm Eric Marcus, and this is Making Gay History. If you've heard of Larry Kramer, then his reputation as a passionate activist with high expectations and a short fuse probably precedes him. If you don't know him, Larry is famous for being one of the first civilians to sound the alarm even before AIDS was called AIDS and became a catastrophic worldwide epidemic that has swept away millions of lives. Back in the early 80s, Larry earned more than a few enemies because of his calls for gay men to cool it with their sex lives. Even before the virus that causes AIDS was discovered, it was clear to Larry and many others that it was a sexually transmitted disease. Coming on the heels of 1970s gay liberation and newfound sexual freedom, almost no one wanted to hear an angry middle-aged man tell them that they had to stop having sex, that it was a matter of life and death. Before the AIDS crisis, Larry was best known for his work as a screenwriter and author. He wrote the Oscar-nominated 1969 screenplay For Women in Love, and he wrote the controversial 1978 novel Faggots, which pulled back the curtain on a world of promiscuous sex and drug use in New York's post-Stonewall gay subculture. It was AIDS that propelled Larry Kramer into the movement. His friends were dying, and he had to do something. In 1982, he co-founded the Gay Men's Health Crisis, now known as GMHC. 5 years later, he co-founded, along with Vito Russo and others, ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. ACT UP came to be known for its brilliant use of public protests to bring attention to the epidemic. By early 1989, when I first met Larry, AIDS had taken more than 60,000 lives, most of them gay men. Given all that, I knew Larry was someone I needed to interview, but I wasn't looking forward to it. I only knew Larry from press reports and television appearances, and from what I could see, he had more than earned his reputation as an uncompromising, angry, outspoken firebrand who was unafraid to offend. That's not the Larry Kramer I found on a winter afternoon at his apartment in New York City. I had braced myself for a tornado, and I found a teddy bear. So here's the scene. I'm sitting opposite Larry in his Greenwich Village living room. We're separated by his broad desk in a room that's all white. Out the window, I can see Washington Square Park and in the distance, the twin towers of the World Trade Center. As I set up my tape recorder and attach the lapel mic to Larry's shirt, we chat about how we both had wanted to find a husband early in life and settle down. And that leads us back in time to Larry's memories as a confused and unhappy college student in the early 1950s. I press record.
Interview with Larry Kramer, Thursday, January 26th, 1989, at the home of Larry Kramer in New York City. Interviewer is Eric Marcus, Tape 1, Side 1.
When I went to Yale, I thought I was the only gay person in the world and tried to kill myself because it was so lonely.
Actually,
so,
did try to kill yourself?
Yeah.
What year was that?
I think that was 53 was the year, my freshman year at Yale. It was awful. I mean, do you want to go back that far?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm also curious because I was a college student on 76, desperately unhappy.
Where?
At Vassar College.
There were a lot of gays.
There weren't that many. People think there were a lot.
Yeah.
I always said if there were so many gays, why was I so unhappy? But I was a miserably unhappy person, and death seemed very appealing at moments during my freshman year when I was dating a woman and sneaking off with a man behind me. And life in 53 at Yale must have been much more difficult than 76 at Vassar.
Well, I mean, I don't know if you could even start in 53. I knew I was gay, I think, from the day I was born. And I think that there had been I now know that there were there were experiences all through before I even got to Yale. And they were all covert and guilt-inducing on everybody's part. So it seemed as if all those early years were spent trying to deny these feelings. The feelings would sort of get too strong and erupt, and I would have an experience which would always make me feel guilty in one way or another, and then you'd be calm. Vesuvius would calm down for a while.
A week or two.
And Yale was awful. There was a gay bar called Pirelli's. It was just awful the time when I finally had the courage to go there. And it was only two blocks from campus, but it was a million years away. It was very dark and gray and inside and smoky and filled with older men. And I only went the once, and somebody picked me up in a car and drove for what seemed like hours before we found a place that was quiet and to do it, and then he drove me back where you didn't say a word, all of that.
How did you try to kill yourself?
I ate 200 aspirin.
Oh, my God. Talk about slow and miserable death. You must have been pretty miserable to swallow 200, and you must have been even more miserable after. So you wanted out? Was that...
Who knows? It's a scene I'll never forget.
The scene of taking the pills, or the scene of waking up and finding you're still there?
I didn't wake up. I went to bed and I got scared and I called the campus police and they came and took me to the hospital and pumped my stomach. And I was in a woke. Then I fell asleep and I woke up in a room with bars and at the Grace New Haven Hospital, and there was this very unpleasant hospital psychiatrist who said, "All right, Mr. Kramer, why did you do it?" And I said, "Go fuck yourself," or words to that. And he said, "You're not going to be let out of this hospital until you tell us why you did it." And I said, he rubbed me the wrong way, and I wouldn't have told him. Who knew why I did it? Anyway. So my brother, who's always sort of looked after me, came and got me out, and he was friends with the dean of freshmen. My brother had been to Yale before me, and it was, you know, ordinarily when something like that happened, you were shipped off to go join the army.
Really?
In those days, yeah. And then you can come back to Yale when you've sort of grown up. But they let me stay if I went to the university psychiatrist. His name was Dr. Fry, Clement Fry, and he was about in the 60s, he had silver hair, and he was a good-looking man. He wore his reptile and his button-down shirt. And you just knew that he cared more about Yale than he ever did about you. And and I told him of this experience that I had had of, I had been invited to go to the room of two of my freshman year, two guys freshman year that I had met. And they somehow mercifully had found each other, and they were living in this room, and I was invited for tea or something. And I walked into this room, and the room, you know how awful freshman year rooms are. Well, they had done their room, and it was painted all black, and there was everything had been taken out of the room except, you know, a low mattress, which was black, and there was a perfect coffee table with a rose and a vase that was spotlit in it. And
that Men Are Born.
And Mabel Mercer is playing on the phonograph, right? So I described this all to Dr. Fry, and Dr. Fry's reaction was, I wouldn't see those guys anymore if I were you. And that's what Yale was like, and that's what going to a psychiatrist was like. So,
and there wasn't a local gay student group for you to call.
There was not. I mean, I love going back to Yale now, and this is my real yardstick of how far we've come, even though I'm always yelling about how we've not come far enough. I go back to Yale, and Yale is like the gay college now. And there's a dance every year for well over 1,000 gay men and women in across the campus from where I tried to kill myself because I thought I was the only one.
So that is your yardstick for change.
It certainly is, yeah.
That in 30 years' time, you were completely alone.
30 years it is. Yeah, God, it's a long time. So, where does that leave us? A lot of change and no change.
Well, yeah.
Well, I guess it's in my nature to be impatient. And I only got politically involved because of AIDS. And there is no question that we have lost the war to AIDS, and that we've lost and will continue to lose a great many people whom we did not have to lose, and that the speed of research, treatment, education, you name it, has been tragically and inhumanely slow. It's an epidemic that need not have happened, and that we should have listened. There's no question that enough people knew what was happening.
Who should have listened? Or, the people specifically who should have listened?
Well, the community. I mean, the gay press, the gay leaders.
You were there before it was an epidemic, or just as it was becoming...
Well, I think now we know that even when we found out in 81, it was much bigger than we thought, but we thought it was just beginning, right? 81, in this very room, in August 81, 80 men sat with Dr. Freedman Keen from NYU, who told us in no uncertain terms exactly what was happening. And he was right.
In 81.
In August of 81. The New York Times article that alerted everybody really was July 3rd, 81. The New York Times headline was something like, rare cancer seen in 41 homosexuals. And it said that all the guys had the same history, which was a history of having had all of these sexual diseases, amoebas, hepatitis A and B, and mononucleosis, and syphilis, and gonorrhea, and you name it. When I saw that in the New York Times, I was scared, because I'd had all of that. And I guess the penny dropped, as the English say, or the bell rang, or something. And I called Larry Mass, who was and is my friend, who is a doctor, and who had written some articles. He wrote a health column for The Native, and had written about it before the Times had. And I guess I'd spoken to him peripherally about it, but not it had the bell hadn't rung, I guess, until the time. I mean, the Times has a way of making you really sit up and say, "Wow."
Well, if the Times covers it, it has to be real.
So he said, go talk to Alvin, to Dr. Freeman Keane, which I did. And Alvin, who turned out to be gay, and we turned out to have mutual friends, said, this is what's happening. You got to stop fucking. You're someone well-known in the gay community. You have to do something about it. Somebody's got to go out there and tell them. And it was because of that that I invited Larry Mass and I and two other guys now dead, Donald Crinsman and Paul Rappaport, invited everyone we knew to come to this first meeting in August.
That include people from political groups, gay political groups?
We got on the phone and we called everybody. We called anyone we could think of, political people, rich people, media people, doctors, none of whom showed up. It was a good cross-section. And it was, you know, a lot of people didn't believe him.
Did you know this was a hot political football when you picked it up? Or did you expect people would respond to you or to what you had to say?
You know, that very meeting that night was in the early evening with Alvin. So that, I mean, there are a lot of very nasty questions put to him. There are a lot of people saying, you know, you're a born again. How can you make all of these assumptions on the basis of so few cases? And how can you expect the whole community to stop fucking? And, you know, there was no virus then. I mean, people say there's no virus now, but there certainly wasn't a virus then. And that didn't come for another couple of years. And people could say, you have no evidence to base this on.
But didn't anyone say, even if there's the slightest possibility?
Well, I mean, that's what he was saying, and that's what I was saying. It wasn't so much the people that Paul Popham and Nathan Fain, who came to be my big adversaries in Gay Men's Health Crisis, it wasn't so much that they didn't believe or not believe what was happening. Paul had, of course, lost a couple of friends by then and a lover. It was that he didn't think it was GMHC's or anybody's position to tell anybody else how to live their lives, and that people had to make up their own minds. So a lot of valuable time was lost not being the conduit. I thought I was setting up or fighting to help set up with others an organization that was going to do one thing, and that organization became and still is another.
What was it?
It was set up to spread information and to fight. To fight to make the system accountable and to spread the word of what was happening and that, you know, we got to cool it. It was not that at all. It became very quickly. It was taken over by the social workers, and it is now what it is then. It's a social service and a very good social service organization. But again, that's our tragedy. It's an organization that helps people to die. It is not an organization that helps the living go on living. And we still don't have an organization to do that, except maybe ACT UP, which came along much too late. Better late than never, but much too late. I blame myself. I am very cognizant of a great failing on my part that I did not have the ability to be a leader, that I did not have the ability to deal with my adversaries and still be friends. God didn't, if there is a God, did not give the gay community a leader when the gay community needed a leader.
And you
still
failed,
hasn't.
And you failed in that role.
And I failed in that role. I feel very strongly I failed in that role.
What does the future hold then?
I think AIDS is going to get much, much, much worse, and a lot more people are going to die. And I hope that one of these drugs is going to do something about it, but I never seem to hear of any let up in the number of people who seem to be getting sick, and that's very scary. And I'm HIV positive myself, which I've just discovered. And
you just were tested the first time?
For the first time, yeah. Mm-hmm. For the first time, it's come home to me in an even more personal way that my days may be numbered in a way that I didn't think of before. And that's made me real sad more than angry. I find myself going back to ACT UP, which I haven't done in a long time because I got fed up with it.
Well, it must be a renewed personal, there's a greater personal interest than before,
gives,
I would think.
That their fighting takes me out of my negativity, makes me just sort of being touched by their positivism helps me.
There are a lot of things I haven't asked you. Is there anything that you would like to comment on?
I don't feel like I've been at my best today with you, and so
I'll come back.
Feel a little specious in what, not specious. Feel a little scattered in what I've said. So I don't know if I've said what I love being gay, and if I have been and am critical, it's only because I think we are very special people and capable of so much more. And it's taken me a long time to be able to say that, because I'm of a different generation than many, you know.
You were born what year?
35. Mm-hmm. And I'm the generation that was sent off to shrinks, because shrinks then thought they could change you, and you were expected to change. And it took a long time for me to come to terms with my homosexuality, and a lot of shrinks. Now, having come to terms with it and liking it, and then having to face AIDS is almost like a bum rap. Nevertheless, it's... you know, I think we are very lucky. I think being a gay man, even today, with AIDS, is a wonderful thing. I love being gay.
After I turned off my tape recorder, Larry Kramer and I talked about his health, which hadn't been great. Besides being HIV positive, two-thirds of his liver had been destroyed by the hepatitis B virus. His doctor told him that he had maybe 3 years to live. But Larry is still alive today. Experimental drugs and a liver transplant in 2001 saved his life. Larry also got his wish to find a husband. Settling down with David Webster in 1991, they married on July 24th, 2013. Larry and I talked about how he'd like to be remembered. He told me that he sees his work, like the landmark play The Normal Heart, as his legacy. But at the risk of disagreeing with Larry, I think his biggest legacy was saving lives through the activism he inspired and his warnings about AIDS, which were heard by more than a few of us, including me. A lot of us owe our lives to Larry Kramer. We've really appreciated all your emails telling us how much you love the Making Gay History podcast. This note came to us from Jason Clark on Facebook. I just wanted to say thank you for the countless hours that you have put into making these recordings and the podcast. I am a 32-year-old gay man, and before I was a teenager, I knew I was gay, and I lost an uncle due to AIDS back then. But he was never out, and I didn't learn that last fact about him until I came out to my grandmother. I feel like I missed a lot of his life because of that. I never understood why he never came out, and your podcast helps me realize that I have taken a lot of freedoms that I have today for granted, that my uncle and millions of others never had. I can't thank you enough for making me realize this. We'd like to include some of your thoughts in your own voices in future episodes, so email a voice memo to us at hello@makinggayhistory.com. And congratulations to Fran Tirado from the podcast Food for Thought for his winning entry into the inaugural Baking Gay History competition at our live event, which we held upstairs at the historic Stonewall Inn earlier this month. Food for Thought's new season is out very soon. Find out more at foodforthoughtpodcast.com. Thank you to everyone who helps Sarah Burningham and me make Making Gay History each week. We couldn't do it without you. Ann Pope, Josh Gwynn, Michael Green, Bronwyn Partis, and Zachary Seltzer. Our theme music was composed by Fritz Myers. Thank you also to our social media strategist, Will Coley, and our webmaster, Jonathan Dozier Ezel. A very special thank you to our guardian angel, Jenna Weiss-Berman. The Making Gay History podcast is a co-production of Pineapple Street Media with assistance from the New York Public Library's Manuscripts and Archives Division and One Archives at the USC Libraries. Season 3 of this podcast is made possible with funding from the Ford Foundation, which is on the front lines of social change worldwide. And if you like what you've heard, please subscribe to Making Gay History wherever you get your podcasts. You can also go to makinggayhistory.com to find all our episodes, plus photographs, notes, and links for all the people we feature in Making Gay History. So long, until next time.
All right, that was Eric Marcus with Making Gay History. If you want to listen to more episodes of that show, you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you're listening to this one. We'll be back next week with a brand new LGBT Q&A, so I will see you there. Bye.
Tame Impala in concert. Tame Impala, Slow Rush Tour. An incredible transcendent live performance. She just said, is it true? Is it true? Tell me now. It's a promise I can make. And I won't. Tame Impala, Class Bell, March 10th. I don't know. I don't care. Get tickets now at evinco.ca.
I'm Martin Carly, and I like to popularize science. Vaccination against COVID-19 for children aged 5 to 11 has begun. As parents, you may be asking if the vaccine is safe and effective. The answer is yes. The vaccine is approved by Health Canada and has been the subject of numerous studies involving thousands of people, including children. Experts also closely monitor any adverse effects that may occur after vaccination.
For more information, visit quebec.ca/youthvaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Do you need quality sounds? Tune into CKUT 90.3 on the frequency modulation band radio. www.ckut.ca on the internet. Streaming audio, archive shows, and information.
CKUT.
The Stonewall Inn was a dump. That's a direct quote from our guest today. You go there in the 60s and dance and have a blast, but what you wouldn't want to do was order a cocktail or mixed drink. Now, this is a detail that I'd never heard before. Jay Toole says that the Stonewall Inn was such a rundown bar that it barely had any running water, and so none of the glasses that they served drinks in really ever got cleaned. Jay was nearby in Washington Square Park when the uprising began that night in 1969. She'd been living there since the age of 13 after her parents kicked her out of the house. And when she and the others who lived in the park heard what was going on, they rushed over. Jay describes it as one of the best nights of her life. It was just utter madness in the most exciting way. She got to yell at cops and throw things at them, and for once, she got to see them scared of her. By that point in her life, most of her ribs had been broken by cops, some multiple times. And so this night was something special, something to celebrate and take advantage of. For over 25 years, Jay Toole lived on the streets of New York City, and the miraculous part of her story, literally miraculous, is that the girl she had a crush on and dated for a brief but intense moment back then, that relationship, through the blessing of the internet and chance, was rekindled just recently, 55 years later. I cannot wait for you to hear that story and get to know Jay, so let's do it. From The Advocate Magazine in partnership with GLAAD, I'm Jeffrey Masters, and this is LGBTQ&A. I want to start off with when you were 13 and kicked out of your family's home for being gay. Going back to that time, 13 is so young in terms of like development and conception of sexuality. That young, what kind of understanding did you have of your own queerness at that age?
I think I've always known that I've liked girls since about maybe 8 or 9, my first kiss. Then I had a crush on my nun. I always felt, you know, there was something strange with me that, you know, I didn't like little boys. Yeah, I think I always knew that it was girls that I wanted to be with.
And so at 13, were you identifying as gay?
You know, when I first came out, I had this friend. You know, none of the kids were allowed to talk to me when I was 12. My mom had a severe mental health issues, so none of the kids were allowed to play with me anymore. But this one girl from a different neighborhood brought me to her home, you know, and it was railroad apartments, you know, back then, tenements. And we walked in, and down this long hallway, there was a bunch of rooms, and it was like she had a gazillion brothers, you know, and this is my brother Bob and John and Jim and Jack. And we got to this room, and this is my sister Florence, and I stopped dead in my tracks. And I stepped back to look in the room, and here was this person named Florence with an Elvis Presley haircut curl coming down, dressed in boys' clothes. I went to that fucking house every day just to see this person. I wasn't quite 13 yet. And eventually she called me in, and she brought me out. And then her and her best friend took me to the Village to Astor Place Barbershop, which is still there, and got me my first haircut, which was a flat top.
What is a flat top haircut?
It's almost like a crew cut, only a little shorter.
Okay. Did you like that?
Oh, my God, yes. Oh, my God, yes. They took me and they bought me a boy's shirt. A maroon. I can see it to this day. A maroon short sleeve shirt, black dungarees, bought me some kicks. And I went home and my father took one look at me. He said, get out. Get the fuck out. So I ended up on the streets at 13 at Washington Square Park, and I lived there for a long time in the bushes, on the benches. And this was 1963, 64, somewhere around there.
Did you go to Washington Square Park that first night?
That first night, yeah.
Was it like just like generally known that like if you didn't have a place to stay, you go there?
Well, those two butches had brought me to the Village a few times. So I knew that there was people like me, you know, that were down there. I didn't talk to anybody for days because I was scared shitless, man. You know, I was in those bushes with the rats and the squirrels and everything else, you know, and these other kids came over to me and they asked me if I was hungry. I joined that little family, you know, and there was so many homeless queer kids out there. Back then, that one section of the park was just queerness. You know, it was just gay. And everybody had their own little family sections, you know. It was amazing.
So this family welcomed you into theirs?
Yeah, they did. You know, they taught me how to survive, how to make money, how to get food, how to steal, you know, how to rob people. You know, it was survival. It was nothing but survival. You know, there's no judgment. I hope that your listeners don't make any judgments of this, because kids are still doing this today. Queer kids are still out on the streets surviving any best way that they can, the way I did 50-something years ago.
Do you feel that people like make judgments about you because of that?
I did, for a long time. When they'd hear my story about, you know, being in jail, all the arrests I've had. So, yeah, I thought, you know, it would scare people away, or they would think, she's still that way. Maybe we better stay away. But I got over that pretty fast, though.
I think like when I think about living on the street, I think of it as like a lonely thing. But it sounds like you had like a family or like had a community there.
Yes. For many years, it was a community of homeless queer kids. As I got older and moved away from the Village, the drug addiction took me to places where it was terribly lonely. I remember this one time I was on 25th Street and 3rd Avenue, and I didn't talk to anybody for over a year. Not a word. Didn't say anything. And this poor woman came walking down the block, and I ran up to her and I said, talk to me. And I scared the shit out of her. She ran around the corner. But I must have come out of whatever, you know. Homelessness takes you to places that you just don't want to go. You know, people don't even think about the different mentalities and the predicaments and the things that homeless people go through. And it's not because we want to be homeless, you know. Back then, there was nothing for us, you know. Today, we have the Ali Forney places, the center. The center wasn't there. You know, there was nothing there where we could go and get help or ask people for help. Back then, as a kid, elders would come through the park. Queer elders, and would, you know, give us food, sometimes take us home with them for showers and a meal, and sometimes it was out of the goodness of their hearts, and sometimes it was for sex, and that's okay. It's how we lived.
Yeah. When you say, like, it was queer people in the park, are you saying the majority of the people in the park are queer, or just, like, your section?
There's one section, if you walk in on McDougal, past the little round circle, that one lane going up the middle of the park, that was completely queer. To the right of that were all drug addicts and alcoholics, and mostly men. Not that we weren't drug addicts and alcoholics, because we were also.
Did it feel safe?
It was safe in that one segment. You never went to the bathroom there by yourself. You'd always go there with your crew, you know, because you didn't know who was in there, who was waiting for you to walk in, that would come in behind you. You know, a lot of queer people have been raped in there and beaten. The cops never bothered us. They didn't care. You know, we weren't causing problems. You know, we were just sleeping, doing our drugs. But we didn't bother anybody.
I know it's a weird question, but how did you, like, afford drugs and alcohol?
Well, we robbed stores. We robbed people. I became a very good pickpocket. Definitely robberies. And then on McDougal, some of the restaurants hired us as cleaning up the tables and things like that for food. And then I got a job with the mafia. I was running numbers. Me and my friend were running numbers for them. And if people don't know what that is, that's like going into a bodega now or a store and buying a lottery ticket for three numbers or four numbers. But back then, there was no computers. People would come up to us, tell us their numbers. We'd write it on a little piece of paper. You know, and they'd give us their 50 cents, a quarter, a dollar, and that money would go back to the mafia. And if their number came back, we'd come back with their money. A funny story is that me and my friend thought it was a good idea not to bring the money back to the guys. So we took the money that we had and we got the whole park stoned. We just spent all of their money. Oh, my God. And the next night, we seen one of their guys coming into the park. And me and my friend took off. And this was maybe about 9, 10 o'clock at night, I guess. And all you could hear was pop, pop, pop. Now, if he wanted to kill us, he would have killed us. Just wanted to scare us. But the next morning, we were on our hands and knees, literally on our hands and knees. Like, please don't kill us. Please don't kill us. We'll get you your money back, you know, whatever. So they didn't kill us, you know, but they did give us a job. And we started dealing heroin in the neighborhood.
Was that to pay them back or just to make your own income?
That was to pay them back. And we didn't mind because we were heroin. I was a heroin user by then. So we, you know, we tapped the bags and use it ourselves. Years later, years later, maybe in 65, 66, I ran into him again. And he said, "You looking for a job?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "I'm running this lesbian bar, the speakeasy." He said, "You want to be the bouncer there?" I said, "Sure."
What was the bar called?
Bohemia. Cafe Bohemia. 15 Barrow Street.
So that was the 60s. You must have been pretty young to be a bouncer.
I was. I was chicken shit, man.
You would not intimidate me at the door.
Oh, back then, man, you would have. You walk in the front of the bar, and it would look like a regular bar. And then you open up this door, and you walk into this, like, lesbian nirvana, man. And I'd sit up on the stage, and there was a jukebox in the corner and tables and everything. And it was illegal for us to be served alcohol, so it was bring your own. When the cops would come to raid it, the guy in front, I'm not mentioning any names, the guy in front would hit the button under the bar, and a red light would go in the back room, right, where I was. And that was for me to make sure that, you know, two girls weren't dancing, there was no alcohols on the table, the jukebox would either go off, just make sure everybody was as safe as possible. But you knew that once the cops came in, they weren't going to go out by themselves, that somebody was going to go with them. But if they didn't like you, you were going for one reason or another. They were not leaving there by themselves. Somebody was going to go, and you just hoped it wasn't fucking you.
I mean, did you even have an ID back then?
I did. It wasn't mine. And I used to pass, and it was Melvin somebody. I had a guy's ID.
And so with your short hair and your, like, button up, you were going by Melvin?
Yeah, you know, chest binder and everything, yeah. Just thought I was a short little guy. Short little young guy.
I mean, when you were talking about the bathroom not being safe at the park, I was thinking about, like, when you're living in the park, like, sleeping on a bench, like, what happens when you get your period?
Well, luckily for me, you know, I get it for, like, half a day, you know, so I didn't have to worry about that shit. But the girls, a lot of socks, a lot of white socks.
Really?
Because you can't afford the Kotex or anything. But a lot of white socks. We'd steal white socks. Wow, I've never been asked that question before.
I didn't know if it was inappropriate. Amongst the family you had at the park, was there like dating and hooking up?
Oh, yeah. Of course. The woman I'm with now, I met in 64, 65 at the Club Bohemia. When she'd come into the park, I'd just make sure I'd say, there's the girl. And that would let the other butchers know, don't fuck, she's mine. You know, we were together for a while, but her family had her put away as a wayward girl. I thought she didn't love me anymore and she didn't come back and this and that, you know, so I went on. And then in 2019, I get this email. I did an interview for Democracy Now! And she's seen me on the Democracy Now! And she sends me an email. Are you her? Did you live in the Bronx? Did you have monkeys? And I wrote back, I said, yeah, that's me. Is this Linda? And we're back together. 55 years later, here we are living together, living our life, you know, because of some stupid shit that happened all those many, many years ago. And our love is like, we just knew. It was like, oh my God. I got on a plane and went to Florida so fast to see her that it made my head spin, you know. And now she's back up here in New York with me, and we're snowbirds.
Jay, that is the craziest thing you've said yet, that you met this woman in the 60s and had a crush on her, and now you're dating.
God, I was in love with her. I bought her a ring. You know, it was illegal to get tattoos back in those days, right? It was illegal. But there was a guy that used to come to the park and give free tattoos. So I bought her a ring, and he married us. And then we had an argument, and she took the ring, and she threw it in the mailbox on McDougal and 8th Street. I sat there all fucking night waiting for the mailman to come to get this ring back, you know? Oh, no, I was in love with her. Still am.
Oh, my God. How old were you back then?
I think I was 17 and she was 16.
I'm sorry. It's just like mind-blowing that you had this happen with this girl as a teenager and now you're together all these years later.
It's quite the love story. It's like, never give up. We didn't break up. We didn't have an argument. It was just something outside things. And maybe that was good because we probably would have killed each other back then.
When you said that girl, I think her name was Florence, when you were like 13.
Yeah.
I think you used the phrase that she brought you out.
Right.
Was that like a sexual experience?
Yes, that was a sexual experience. And I knew right away I didn't like being on the bottom. You know, I just knew it. It was like, oh, no, this doesn't feel right. And it stopped right then and there.
And so at 13, you were kicked out of your home. You must have stopped school then, too, right?
I think it was second week of sixth grade where I stopped school. So my vocabulary isn't that great. You know, you don't have the education to sit down and write something. But when I was in my 60s, I ended up in the New York City shelter system. I got better and everything else. They told me I should take my GED, and I did, and I passed, so I got a GED. I never went into the shelter system because every queer person in New York knows you don't want to go into New York City shelter system because it's not safe for queers. I was beaten up in there by security guards. I was thrown down a flight of stairs by security guards. But then also I used to buy my crack from the social workers. You know, there was a shelter in Brooklyn called BWS, which we called Bitches with Stems. And we'd buy our crack from the social workers there.
From the staff members?
Yeah. Social workers, maintenance men, all of them. You know, it was notorious back then. It was bad.
I mean, I wonder, like, living on the street for that long, was it 30 years?
It's close to 30 years. You know, I've lived in the parks, I've lived on sidewalks, I've lived in boxes. I lived down underneath the train platforms of Penn Station. That's when they sweep the tracks, they sweep all the garbage into these rooms, and that's where I lived with the rats, man. It was insane.
So, like, living for 30 years like that, I just wonder, like, today, like, how did that imprint itself on you that shows up in ways still?
Well, I can't walk past a homeless person without giving money or a cigarette, you know, because I know what it's like to be out there and acknowledge them. You know, being out there, people walk past you all day long. You know, they don't see the homeless. And I tell people, you don't have to give money. You just walk by and say, hey, you know, you don't have to give anything. You don't have to stay there and have a big conversation with people. Let us know that, you know, you've seen us. We know you're there. You know, we can't help you, but we know you're alive, that you're there.
I mean, I think that, like, our ability to walk by a homeless person on the street and, like, carry on with our day and, like, not, like, think about it again is, like, a scary fact of, like, being human.
It's sad. You know, it is. And now that I look back on it, you know, I've been out of homelessness, 20 years, I think, this year. Yeah, it was lonely, you know, and you know, you don't trust anybody. It took me a long time to trust people, to actually have a conversation with people. When I was in the shelter system in New Providence, where I graduated from, they gave me a diploma. When I sobered up in there, I looked around and I seen how really bad shelters were, you know, and I started thinking about it. And I started taking all the soda cans that people would drink, wash them out, bring them back and get money for it so that I'd have money so that when a new girl came in and she didn't have a toothbrush or she didn't have this, I could get that for her. Well, if you were sent to the hospital, mainly the mental institutions, they'd send you to Bellevue on them immediately. I'd go visit them and bring them candy or snacks. I wanted to treat people the way I wanted to be treated and wasn't. I never wanted anybody to feel the way I did. And I tried my best, you know, not to do that.
Wow. So what was that process like for you to finally stop living on the streets?
You know, they put me in this place in the late 90s. And it was a good shelter. It was, shelters are bad, 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 bad. But this was one of the better ones. The director was queer. My social worker was cool. And I keep on leaving the shelter and going out and smoke crack and come back. You know, my social worker would just, she wouldn't say nothing to me. She'd lean into my ear and say, it's your choice. It's your choice. You know, and I never heard it. I never heard that it was my choice. So I went out this one night and these kids in front of Madison Square Garden walked past me and said something really derogatory to me. And I said something back to them. And they had these small lead pipes and beat me in my head. Oh, I mean, one of the worst beatings I've ever had. And I went back to my shelter and they put me in the hospital. And it was there, you know, when I started waking up and all bandaged up and everything, it was there that it was like, oh, it's my choice. I don't have to go out there and get high and get beaten up and maybe murdered, you know, like so many other people that I knew were killed out there. So when it was time to leave the hospital, I called my social worker at the shelter and I said, I don't want to use anymore. Can you send somebody to get me? I don't want to have to come back by myself. And they didn't have anybody. So this was in June of, I think, 2000 or 1999. And I had a few dollars in my pocket. I walked out of that hospital and walked from the 70s in Presbyterian to the 40s. And I just kept on saying, well, you can buy a six pack of beer. You can buy a couple of hits of crack because crack was only $2 back then for a cap. And I just kept telling myself, nah, you know, wait till the next corner, wait till the next corner. And I got back to the shelter without picking up. And I never picked up crack again or heroin or pills.
Did the shelter help you find a place to live after that?
Yeah, you know, they had this, and I think it's a wonderful program, and I don't know if they still have it. They got me this wonderful apartment in Brooklyn, huge, huge place, and I stayed there, and that's when I got involved. I went to school to become a substance abuse counselor. I passed everything. I got money because I was best in my class and this and that, but I never went for the test because I realized that I didn't want to sit at a desk and try to just help one person. That I needed to go back into the streets, back into the shelter system, and do as much help as I could for many people, maybe. You know, I used to do tours. Hopefully next summer I'll be able to start those tours again. I started in 1963 and work our way up through the village, what it looked like, what it smelled like, what it tasted like.
What did it taste like?
It tasted good, and sometimes it was crap. It was crap when the cops grabbed you and you caught those beatings. Or the Women's House of Detention, where I've spent some time there.
The Women's House of Detention's pretty famous, and I don't think many people, like, outside of New York has heard of them.
Yeah, I think it was a 10-story building.
It was around from, like, the 30s or the 70s. Primarily queer women were housed there. Or, I mean, not housed, but, like, imprisoned, right?
Yeah, right.
Housed sounds too nice.
That place was a nightmare and a playhouse. all in one. I was there. I was arrested a lot.
Why was it a playhouse?
Well, because, you know, in the movies, they show that they pull a lever and the doors close, right? The cell doors close. Back then, they didn't. The CO, the correction officer, the CO, would come down the hall and close your gates, right? Boom, 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 boom. So everybody, you could smoke back then. Everybody smoked filter cigarettes. Even if you didn't smoke filter cigarettes outside, you smoked it in jail. Because we used to break off the filter, stick it in the jam of the lock, right? When she'd come, it sounded like it was locking, but it wasn't locking. So there's four tiers, cell block A, B, C, and D, and then a long corridor in the middle, and that's where she would sit at night. So when she'd fall asleep or whatever she was doing out there, we'd open up our cell doors and go visit our friends, our friends, our girlfriends, our mates, you know. So that was part of a playhouse back then, you know. There was always something going on. You know, the nightmare of it was, you know, the physical... The physicals they give you when you first go in were horrendous. I don't know if it was harder on butchers or if this was all women. I'm not sure. But it was terrible, terrible, terrible. And I can feel it in my bones. I can still feel it in my bones. I can taste it, you know, what was done.
Wow. I should say, too, that the historian Hugh Ryan has a book coming out about the House of Detention next year.
Yeah, I mean it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, he's my buddy. Aww. Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding, too, is that, like, the Women's House of Detention was a place, it was like a queer gathering place, almost like a Stonewall bar. Like, this was a part of, like, community almost, like, in a presence in, like, your lives, right?
Yeah, you know, the building itself was a presence in our lives, you know. And inside, also, it's your own communities, your own cell block, mostly queer or gay for the stay, one or the other. But yeah, it was mostly queer, and, you know, sit around, sex, yes. Usually I was always on the side that the window looked out on Whalen's Drugstore, which was 8th Street and 6th Avenue, Whalen's Drugstore in Needix. And that's where all the lesbians would meet. I'll meet you at Whalen's. Everybody knew, go to Whalen's, and that's where everybody would meet up. You know, and when I was in jail, I'd look out that window and see them all down there. And I'd say, oh, look at those idiots. It took me years to realize. I said, wait a minute, they're outside. I'm inside. I'm the idiot. So my arrests were for, like, not having the three articles of female clothing on, drugs. Too many things. Too much crap.
We also, I guess, I would be, like, fired if we didn't talk about Stonewall. Before we get to Stonewall, though, can you describe that bar for everybody and, like, what it was like?
Oh, what a dump. It was a dump back then. You know, it's not too much better now. You walk in, it was dark, smelly. You never drank any mixed drinks there. Ever, you know, because they hardly had any running water. So the glasses were always washed in dirty water. And you didn't know what was in the bottles that they were giving you. So you either brought your own little bottle.
No way.
But yeah, you didn't buy any mixed drinks in there. The bartenders were friendly. You know, the bar now is only one section. Back then it was two sections. And there was an alcove in the back where you'd walk in the bar, and then maybe halfway through, you could swing into the other room of Stonewall. And that's where mostly we hung out. Music was always blasting. People were dancing. We were at home where we could be ourselves and hold each other and dance together.
And so the night of the uprising, when it began, you were in the park when you heard about it, right?
I was. There was a bunch of us, you know, and we were sleeping in the park. And it was early in the morning, maybe 1, 2.
Do you remember specifically about what you heard was going on? I asked because police raids were not uncommon. So, like, what did you hear to let you know that what was happening was something special, something unique?
Yeah. You know, we didn't have cell phones back then, and everything was by word of mouth. You know, and the village, man, you couldn't keep a secret in the village if you wanted to. You know, you just couldn't. So word came into the park. They said something was going on at Stonewall. Something's going down at Stonewall. And just by the sound of it, you know, if it was a raid and somebody was just coming, you know, okay. But it was a different sense, you know, that this was different. Now, when I got there, it was already, things were happened already, you know, people were arrested. I do remember the lieutenant yelling into the crowd to get back, and nobody was really moving, and someone threw a bottle. Then he started yelling, whoever threw that bottle, come out, we're going to arrest you. Like, who was going to come out? Really? You know, the streets were just, oh my God, the streets was just yelling. it felt so empowering to be able to yell at a cop and not get beat up. You know, and a lot of people did get beat up that night. But it was, just to yell at them and scream at them and throw things at them and see them scared. You know, you could see it in their eyes that they were scared. And it must have surprised them that they were scared of a bunch of gay people. You know, like, what the hell? You know.
So it sounds like utter madness, but also like fun madness.
It was. I think it was one of the best nights I've ever had when it came to doing things like that. And I look back on it for that one little moment, even though we didn't like each other or to get along with each other, maybe that one moment in time, we all came together. All of us came together to say, enough is enough. You got to stop. You have to stop beating us. You have to stop arresting us. You just have to stop and let us live. Let us live. Again, being homeless and an addict, every day we were fighting for our lives with the cops. Most of my ribs have been broken multiple times by cops and fighting for who I believed in, which was myself. This is who I am. I'm not going to change.
Once you did finally get that first apartment in Brooklyn in your 50s, I think you were. Did it take a while to adjust to that?
I stayed in my apartment for a month with no lights because I was embarrassed to ask somebody, how do you turn lights on? I was too embarrassed to say, how do I turn my lights on? You know, well, you have to go to the electric company. Well, I went to the electric company. No one told me that I have to bring a lease with me. No one told me that I need credit. I didn't know any of this stuff. And when I went to work at in the shelter system, one of the things we would go through was ADL. Adult daily living is like, when you get out, this is what you have to do. Don't get stuck. Because if you're homeless for that long, you don't know. You don't know how to do the washing machine. I didn't know what a cell phone was. We're living on 31st Street, and we seen all this. One day we noticed these people walking down blocks, and we thought, because we were close to Bellevue, we thought that they let everybody out of Bellevue because they were talking to themselves, not even realizing that these were cell phones they were talking into. All you know is your homeless family, and we all knew the same thing, survive.
So you're missing out on these like massive leaps in technology.
Yes, yes.
If someone is kicked out of their home, if they have nowhere to stay, if they can't stay with friends or family, if like you, there were not like shelters that were safe, do you have suggestions for people in that position?
Unfortunately, the only places, you know, really are the shelter system, and they're not the best, and I'm not advocating anybody to go into them. But I would, if you're queer, get a hold of the center, get a hold of Coalition for the Homeless, definitely get a hold of Partnership for the Homeless. Anya's queer, and she would definitely help. And she always has her hand out. She's the one that dragged me out of this homelessness.
Are there parts of living on the street that you miss?
Yes.
Like what?
Paying bills. I didn't have to pay any bills back then. Now I got to remember, you know, I have everything on auto because I probably wouldn't pay them. You know, I miss the air, sleeping outside in the air. Yeah, that's about it.
When was the last time you slept outside? Like by choice?
When I went down to see Linda, we slept on a trampoline. We're in our 70s, we went, what a fucking trampoline. Are we insane or what? And we slept out on the trampoline. Yeah, I couldn't sleep out there anymore. It's brutal, it's hard, you know, it's so hard on your body. The people that I see out there now, and it seems like so many more, and the kids out there, it just breaks my heart when I see them or talk to them. You know, they're thrown out for the same reasons I was thrown out. You know, whatever the reasons why these kids are out on the streets where they shouldn't be. We just got to do better, you know, as adults. Because even though I'm talking about my history, there's so many more out there that are my history. It's our history. And people got to know what it was like out there and what it's still out there today.
I appreciate you taking so much time with me. Thank you for this.
I thank you. And you're a little cutie pie.
And that was Jay. Big thank you to them and also to Sage, who connected us. If you don't know, Sage is a really fantastic nonprofit that specifically focuses on advocating for LGBTQ elders. So they do really, really important work. Thank you so much to them. And then as always, if you enjoyed this interview or any of our previous ones, please help us spread the word. We ask every week because it is important when you tell your friends or your social media followers, those are all the biggest ways you can help our show continue to grow. So
Thank you so much to everyone who does that. We're brought to you by The Advocate Magazine in partnership with GLAAD. I'm Jeffrey Masters. I will see you next week. Bye.
CKUT Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
Fa la 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 la. Deck the halls with boughs of holly. Fa la 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 la. Tis the season to be jolly. Fa la 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 la. Wash hands, use hand sanitizer. Fa la 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 la.
You know the tune. If you're celebrating with a few loved ones this holiday season, keep following all the health measures. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Écoutez Les Beaux Sons avec Nathalie Di Palma. Sur les ondes de CKUT, le 90.3 FM.
Bonsoir. Pour terminer l'année en beauté, nous vous offrons une émission toute en musique pour souligner le temps des fêtes et on commence tout de suite avec Lady Gaga qui nous chante Christmas Tree, qui sera suivie de Qu'en décembre d'Era Ménard et de nul autre que Madonna pour souligner les vacances bien méritées. À tout de suite.